Where are we?
Okay, this is session six, class five, mitzvah 166 through, I hope, 169 today. So this is very interesting stuff, because we're going to see some differences in our thought processes in two different mitzvahs today, hopefully. So the first one is the precept about the ritual uncleanness of a woman after childbearing. So this is tum'ah, ritual uncleanness. It has nothing to do with cleanliness. We just don't have a translation for that. So I don't have to go into that. You all know that. So here's the idea. A woman who gives birth, to declare ritually unclean. A woman who gives birth, period. That's the mitzvah. But she's tum'ah. Right, so, and then there's different levels of tumah. If she has a male child, she's tumeah for a week, and if she has a female child, she's tumeah for 2 weeks. So we have a way of understanding that today that's different than how he understands it. So I think it's fascinating. It's important to understand this book is ta'amei ha-mitzvot. Ta'am of a mitzvah is the taste of a mitzvah. We say ta'am ha-mitzvot instead of siba ha-mitzvah, the reason of the mitzvah, because we don't know the reason for the mitzvah. And it's very important to keep that in mind. While this book is full of reasons, we have to remember, it's very important, especially when you see a mitzvah like this, as we'll discuss in just a minute, that these are ta'amei ha-mitzvot. So a ta'am, the difference between a ta'am and a siba, is that it's just a ta'am is to give you a flavor, to suggest a reason with what we know, if possible. Hello. To suggest that reason, but it doesn't mean it necessarily is the reason. Of course, the mitzvah stands with or without a reason. It's just the flavor. So the flavor of something is what makes it yummy. It makes it so that you would want to do it. So a reason can also do that on an intellectual level, but this is just a ta'am. So we'll see that the ta'am here is very different. And it's fascinating to see what was going on in the... How the centuries 13, work. This is the 14th century, right? In the 1300s, what they thought about how bodies work.
So is this a taf or a tet? Tet mem?
Ta'am. It's a
tet.
A tet, yeah. Tet. Ta'am, with an ayin. Tet ayin mem. Ta'am.
And that means taste?
Taste, yeah. It means taste in English, the way taste is in English also. Like poor taste and good taste, in terms of, you know, how something works in a house also. You could say she has a nice ta'am. You know, the house is tastefully decorated, so it means that kind of taste, but it also means tongue taste. Oh. You know, it's ta'im. Ta'im is tasty.
You said tet ayin what?
Tet ayin mem, Sophie.
Versus, and what was the other word? Versus.
Siba. Siba. Siba is really samech, yod, bet, hey, siba. Siba is a reason. So these are ta'mitzvot, not sibot. Occasionally you get a real reason, but in general mitzvot are there because Hashem decided they should be there, and we try to find a tam to it, and we're permitted to look, and we look with the best of our intellectual capabilities and information that exists at the time, which doesn't always work with each time, but the mitzvah stands nonetheless. Okay, so that being said, it's interesting, now that I gave my introduction, so we'll give an introduction here too, because he says, and this is the first time I've seen this in the book, says Mishor Shei HaMitzvah, from the roots of the mitzvah, Hakdama. Here's an introduction first. Before he gives the reason for the mitzvah, he wants the root of the mitzvah, he wants to give an introduction. So there's no doubt that human illness, this second paragraph, come either on account of excess in the body or a deficiency, or on account of the same damage or of some damage or deterioration which it suffers from whatever cause there may be. For in truth, as long as nature is straight or balanced to the utmost degree and has not suffered any sort of damage, the body will not sicken. But the sin of people will lead them to have an excess or a lack in what is needed for their nature, and they will fall ill. So first of all, we do today believe that there could be physical manifestations of spiritual ailments or of we believe in psychosomatic illness caused by things. Yeah, we believe in that. And we also spiritually believe in spiritual ailments, although we don't believe in the straight, you did this, so you get this today. We don't believe that.
Causal.
Right. So it's interesting how he describes the causal thing. So nature, that we are straight, and as long as we stay straight and balanced, no problems will happen, but...
So that's sort of very consistent with Oriental medical
yeah.
idea of
cold and hot.
Yeah,
and
yeah, so we're going to get to that totally right that. Here. It's fascinating. Wait till you
so
see this.
So that was all very consistent.
Yes, it's times. Really interesting. So
still today, people that practice that believe it very strongly.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to say that, yeah, it's consistent with that. It's not consistent with how we believe right now. It doesn't mean that that maybe we'll learn something different. So I think we're
moving more in that direction.
I don't want to say that our for sure science is more advanced. I do want to say that. There's no question that we understand more about how things work today. And there's also a Western conceit where we might not be holding some things as true or valuable. So I don't want to say that we should that everything that the sages wrote in the 1300s about science is true and we're just waiting for our science of today to catch up back to that. That's not what I'm saying. But what I do want to say is there may be some principles that were shed. Maybe sometimes the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. I don't know. But I don't want to say for sure this stuff isn't true. Some things we'll see aren't, and some things may still be. We may still find something in them. So I don't want to just totally say not.
Well, and sometimes they had the concept, but they didn't know the underlying medical
cause. Why exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And to me, that's fantastic.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, and if you look at this you say, okay, what if you don't eat the right things?
Mm-hmm.
Then your body falls ill.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, we eat too much fat. We've proven it. Your body will fall ill.
Right. Yeah. Except for those people who are skinny and eat only ice cream.
I mean, there are some.
There are some.
There's no Torah.
They eat whatever they want, and they look fabulous, feel fabulous.
Are they going to live long time?
And they do.
We know a marathon runner who just had a stroke at 50 years old.
That's what you get for running marathons.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. That's why you should have a sedentary lifestyle.
Excess.
That's right. Excess. Sit.
Excess is right. Yeah.
Sit, read, and learn. That's what you should do. Okay. For this reason, our sages, I'm skipping half a paragraph here. So it talks about the menses and why somebody in that. So it's interesting. Well, I guess we should look at it. What's stated earlier, the injunction about the trefa and about forbidden foods that God discussed earlier that we looked at last time, that he removes his people from the ones that he chose, so the Jews specifically, from all things that harm the body, because the body is an instrument for the soul that knows its maker. So we discussed that last time. Similarly, for the same root reason, he removed us from a woman who gave birth, as well as from one unclean on account of the menses, and one who has had a discharge for a few days. That's we talked about the different kinds of tumah. So that's a zav, tumah, until they're cleansed of that excess which is in them. So now he's saying that the giving birth, the menstruation, and the zav are all excesses, which are bad things and cause illness. As we said, every excess is a root cause of illness. For this reason, our sages of blessed memory said that no woman sees blood of the menses without her head and limbs being heavy on her, whatever that means, and it gives lots of different sources. Then, without any doubt, in the excess lies illness for them and for anyone who comes in close to them. And all the more certainly for anyone in conjugal intimacy, which is the utmost kind of physical proximity. The child, too, formed while this excess dominates them, is prone to many ills. So that's where I would say that our medicine doesn't... We do see children are weaker.
Right.
Could it be that there's some excess that spills onto the children as the... I don't know. Look, that's certainly not our medical paradigm of today. But we definitely see that babies are weaker, no question about that. So who knows?
Is there not a trend, Aliza, that a woman who's had many children, and I'm going to say from 10 up, let's say from...
You could probably go lower than that. Maybe
could be 8 up, that it seems like there are more medical problems or emotional problems. The emotional problems could stem from...
Oh, in the kids,
being
you're
the eighth, tenth, yeah, in the child. Uh-huh. Much less what happens to the mother's body when she has one child almost after another with very little recuperative rest between them. It seems like the children have a few more ailments or a few more physical problems as you get down towards
more autism.
Have you 11, 12, 13 children.
Taken people with that many kids.
I know a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, I know a number
of them. The problem
is
that you have certain, nutrients in your body that if you have another baby after another baby after another baby, your body doesn't get a chance to recover from that. So, you know, now you shouldn't have you shouldn't get pregnant for like a year and a half after you've had one baby.
Right.
So if you think about your hematocrit, your iron stores, so the baby gets iron from you, you have to take iron in. That's why most people, a lot of people.
So that's probably why.
But if you don't, if you have another kid too soon, then your hematocrit's not up, then that's going to make you not be able to give iron to, or you're going to keep getting weaker. It's more the mom that gets weaker, but obviously if they're so depleted,
the fetus takes from the mom,
the mom that's
which weakens
weaker.
The mom even worse.
So if it gets to a certain, I mean, it would have to be pretty severe on the mom that the baby's not even getting what the baby needs and stuff. But
seems like I've just seen it. You know,
it could definitely be that, you know, as a mom has one after another after another after another, that she might deplete her stores enough that.
Right, but they would have to be really, really depleted for the baby not to get what the baby needs. Because the baby's going to take from mom even if mom's depleted.
Right.
So mom's going to be anemic, but the baby's still going to have the right hematocrit.
Uh-huh.
So it would have to be really, really bad for them. I mean, the mom would have to be sick on her own heart before it would affect what the baby got.
Uh-huh.
Because it's amazing,
that
people can acclimate, and you'd see hematocrit
in
somebody who's not pregnant,
and
you'd be, you know, you say, aren't you symptomatic? And they, no, but somebody who's not pregnant would be, like, really tired, you know.
And not to speak of, you know, taking care of that many young children.
I was going to say, emotionally the child could be affected because the mother has nothing left to give.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't know what's with autism, why that's increasing so much. They don't
know
what
that is. Why it's in later children and...
Yeah, I don't know if,
I don't know if it's in later children.
I don't know but the autism rate is so high, but I don't think they know why.
Well, the spectrum
has
been enlarged so much.
Right,
and that's
another thing.
I do too.
We used to just call these kids difficult kids.
Or slow, or whatever.
Yeah. Difficult, slow, unmanageable. They just need more discipline. You know, the ones that are on that far end of it,
mild,
where
they're
more what's the word I'm looking for, more
Asperger's,
like an Asperger's, more functioning, high functioning. That was the term I was looking for.
I watched the story of Temple Grandin.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
It was really interesting.
Show.
Yeah, really interesting.
What is that?
Temple Grandin. She's a autistic.
Oh yes. Oh, she's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, she is quite amazing.
It was fascinating.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
She's really
she appears on different television shows at different times. Also, I mean, she's very high functioning.
Yeah.
All to say, but she has her problems with relationships, of course, and she knows it. She knows she has those problems.
Yeah.
No, give her a cow anytime. She said that.
Yeah, well, probably there's a lot of people that might say that.
Or that should say that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so now let's continue looking at it a little bit, how it's different. So the root that we stated of the excess, and now it's going to say in this page.
Yeah, this is sort of what's strange.
Yeah, right? Is that, let's see, I think the second paragraph, or the first paragraph on page 203 says that if she conceives a boy... Then that means that she's warm inside. And if she conceives a girl, it indicates coldness in the woman's physical nature, and a coldness in the excess substances increase, which is why. So this is what he's saying is the...
That sounds Chinese.
Right? It's interesting to think about the cold
and
the warmer, what that means.
Because we know that now the sex of the child is determined by the male.
Well, so we know that that has to do with the... semen that it determines it, but then there's acidity in the woman that's
the
more,
acidity,
hospitable,
right. That's more
to one or to the other. So there is
some
kind of participation there.
Right.
In addition to, you know, how good swimmers they are and when the ovulation occurs and all that stuff. So it's not just. I mean, in the end, it's just who makes it to the egg.
Right.
But there's a lot of stuff that goes on before, you know, when
that
when
can make the environment more
and make it work better. So and we do see that there are some women who are just, you know, boy producers or girl producers because of whatever is going on inside of them. It's not because of their husbands necessarily. So here it's talking about the white humor of the mother's womb was a large amount and cold, and therefore she bore a female. So it's just interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. Hence, she needs great cleansing on account of the accretion of humors and the foul blood in them on account of their coldness. It is known that cold illnesses require for their cleansing a greater length of time than those with heat. thus far his words. His words being he's quoting the Ramban. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting just to look at those differences.
It's fascinating.
Right, and that's why I just wanted to say ta'amehemitzvot, because even if we say that's not our medical paradigm at all today, it doesn't mean that the mitzvah doesn't apply. The mitzvah does still apply. But we, for different reasons. So today, the way that we... Today's discussion is much more spiritual. Today's discussion is what is tuma and tahara. The thread that binds almost all tumas together is a brush with death. Somehow, some type of connection with death. So so a period is the loss of life potential, mm-hmm. right? So it's not exactly death, but it's a loss mm-hmm. of potential of life. And giving birth to a child is also a life actually exiting somebody. So there is, really, it leaves behind a life vacuum in the woman. A boy leaves behind a single life vacuum as he exits, which leaves behind a tumah, a life vacuum, right? And a dead body, when the soul leaves, is the largest life vacuum possible, so it's the most tummy thing possible. But the birth of a female child leaves behind a double life vacuum, because not only does she exit, but her eggs exit with her. Mm. So she and her womb leave the mom, so that her life and the potential life that she has in her both leave, which leaves a double vacuum, which is why your tummy for double the length of time than you are for a boy. So that's our current, or certainly the one that I use, explanation. But he's using a much more physical one, which is interesting to see, especially because he has more spiritual explanations here and there, but that's not the one that he's using. So again, tamei hamitzvot, not sibot hamitzvot, right? Okay, so let's see, at the bottom of the page, our sages of blessed memory wrote about the menstruant by way of the plain meaning, so here he wants to say, the reason why a man stays away from a menstruant woman for those 7 days is because of this excess, and it's physically dangerous. But he also now wants to add that it helps marriages stay strong if he stays away from her during that time, because then she won't become too familiar, and it'll keep their sex life alive if there is some distance too. So that doesn't really have to do with the physicalness of it. And then he goes on to discuss all the different types of bleeding and what there are, and that you don't bleed without some type of a reason, and that we have fences around bleeding. That the first week of bleeding after a birth is considered tummy blood, and after the first week it's considered tahor blood. Even though, and it says it comes from the same place. It's mm-hmm. one fountain. It's the time. It says the word fountain. One fountain of blood, but two separate time periods. So it has to do with the time. And then it talks about even if you give birth without blood, we just would assume that you didn't see the blood, not that there wasn't blood, because we have a rule that there is no birth without blood. And then it talks about miscarriages. So it's a long thing. You might be interested in reading the whole thing if you want to, but it talks about miscarriages, and it talks about weird things that you might miscarry too, what they might look like. Let's look on page 209. I'll just read the page before 207. And there is the law for one who aborts something like the embryo of a domestic or wild animal or a fowl. What is the ruling for her? And if their faces are like human visages or are not like human visages, what is the law for her? Further, there are the laws of one who aborts something like gnats or something like hair, one who aborts a human form that has wings of flesh, likewise one who aborts a human form with one eye and one thigh, and one who aborts a male fetus and a flat fish shape with it, which is the creature that cannot be identified as male or female. Then we have the law of the woman who went out full, pregnant, and came back empty long after her delivery, and she is uncertain in her reckoning. So then what do you do? So it's just telling you all the different laws that apply and what you might do in all those different situations. But let's just look back on page 207, the second to the last paragraph. It talks about this fence that's been adopted. So already at that time, and I think it was much, much earlier, but now, however, so in terms of the blood, and it comes, there's the tahor week, the tummy week, and the tahor week. But now we have this, all joy has adopted the practice and fenced itself about with the protective resolution to observe the laws of defilement over the blood of ritual purity, just as over the blood of impurity. So even if the blood is tahor blood, we treat it like tame blood. The crux of the matter is that now a woman does not ever rise out of her ritual uncleanness until she experiences 7 whole days free of any blood, beginning to count them from the evening. This is a great and good rule followed in all locations of worthy observant Jewry, and by it we are saved from many doubts. So
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not clear, because earlier he talks about the fact that in the case of a birth, even if you still have blood, after the week or the 2 weeks, you go to the mikveh and you are clean. But now he says this. So
he didn't say you go to the mikveh. He just talked about the different... So the way that the halacha today, the way that we learn it is, that's the minimum amount of time.
The minimum, okay.
So even if you would just give birth and bleed for 1 day, you still have to count 7 days. You're still...
Seven clean days.
Seven days of blood.
Right. See, that's...
And then we also tack on seven clean days.
Okay, that was my question. Right. Because here it says, even if she has a discharge of blood that very night of the 8th day, she undergoes immersion and is ritually pure.
Right. And so
At that time,
that first week was Tameh and the second week is Tahor, so that after the first week, even if she would have blood on the 8th day, it's saying she could still go to the mikvah because she's past the first week.
Okay. But now
we don't do that because now we have this protective fence,
which is the seven clean days.
So now we wait.
Other interesting thing is that this address of abortion.
No, not of abortion. It's of spontaneous abortion, of miscarriage.
Right.
It's spontaneous abortion. It's not of abortion because it's. That, I mean, that's how you even use that today, right? In modern, it's called spontaneous abortion.
Right.
Is what a miscarriage is.
Expel. Right.
Why do you use the word spontaneous abortion instead of miscarriage? What's the difference between the
two? Miscarriage is like a lay term. An abortion just means that, you know, you've lost the pregnancy.
Uh-huh.
So you can have a therapeutic abortion, which is where you actually do an abortion.
Uh-huh.
You cause it. Or you have a spontaneous abortion where your body did it on its
own. That's interesting. It's called therapeutic. It wouldn't always be therapeutic necessarily.
It's called therapeutic. It's a treatment. Therapeutic. Treatment. Therapy.
Right. I'm just saying it makes it sound like a positive treatment, which I'm sure some abortions would be therapeutic. Let's say whatever, for whatever reason, if the mom was too sick. I don't know. She had to have chemo, right? Mm-hmm. Or this was in the way of her recovery or something. Then it would be a therapeutic abortion as opposed to I just don't feel like.
You could see therapeutic for psychological reasons.
Even psychological. But let's say you don't feel like it.
Well,
right.
Then
that's not really therapeutic.
It depends on how you think about it.
Right,
if you really don't want to be pregnant
and
you have a baby, then that could be more harmful to the kid to raise a kid that you don't want.
Or you can give it up for adoption.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. It's interesting that that word is
TAB stands for therapeutic abortion versus TAB. SAB, which is spontaneous abortion.
Oh, interesting. Okay, and so miscarriage in medical speech
is you'd say spontaneous abortion, yeah.
But that's late term. In the medical world, it's later.
You said miscarriage is later.
No. Lay.
Lay. Miscarriage is lay.
Oh, and sorry.
SAB is spontaneous abortion versus a TAB, which is a
Okay, so those are the two medical words, and miscarriage is a lay term. Okay, good. I thought you said late term.
No,
okay.
But let's say if you're writing down how many times someone's been pregnant, which is gravity, and then how many full term, more than 20 weeks you've had as a para, then you do AB, which is abortions, and you don't specify if it's a SAB or a TAB, it's just abortions, AB, and then you have a number. So.
Interesting. Okay, interesting. All right, next, 167. A ritually unclean person is not to eat meat of holy sacrifices. So they're not supposed to go into the Beit HaMikdash, but they're also not supposed to eat. So whether this is a person is in Nida or any type of other ritually unclean, any type of other tumah that a person is, they're not supposed to eat kodshim, holy sacrifices. So that would be if they killed an animal that's not a kosher animal, or whatever they did, or certainly if they were involved in war, whatever it is. All right, on page 211, at the root of the precept lies the purpose that we wrote above in 95, which is about building the Beit HaMikdash and all the honor that's accorded to it and trying to create an environment of honor. To establish in our spirits a reverent fear, awe, for the sanctuary and its holy offerings. It is therefore not fitting that any but the ritually pure should eat them, since purity is a quality of excellence and honor for a man, as any understanding person knows. Here, man means person. So this is for all people. But it does talk about, it learns, It derives from the ritual impurity of a female who gave birth, about all different types of impurities, also other types of ritual impurity, and why those people wouldn't be permitted, or the categories of people who wouldn't be permitted. Somebody who does it on purpose, eats on purpose, knowing that they're ritual impure and knowing that the food would be impermitted to them in that state, would receive karet, that is spiritual excision. Same thing you get for eating on Yom Kippur or for eating chametz on Pesach. But if you do it by mistake, then you get lashes. Okay. So here...
I guess... be making many mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, people should be careful. Because a mistake also means... It's not... we think of mistake as being... We're totally absolved from it. It's a mistake. Well, you know what? You make mistakes because... You were doing something
careful.
Else you shouldn't have been doing, right? So you
careful.
Can't say it was a mistake to drive through a red light if you were texting. And it was a mistake to drive through the red light. But you should not have been texting while you're driving, right? Mm. So the same thing with other things. You should be paying attention in life that you shouldn't make a mistake. So why it's a lower level transgression, much lower than the actual Avera.
But still, I think that's a very good point. And I think today,
I think so. we
frequently just sort of said, well,
it's an accident.
Right. And that's sort of, as you said, we tend to interpret as that, so it shouldn't matter.
Right, right.
It's
and
easy
still,
for
and your
us
point
to
is,
blow
it still matters.
It does
off.
Still matter, right, because you weren't paying attention to something else.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so there still is, it's a lower level, but it still was wrong to make that type of mistake because you opened yourself up to that mistake, whatever you were doing or not doing.
Right.
You know, the consciousness that wasn't there. So, like, for instance, I mean, this is a hard thing, but let's say Shabbos morning. Sometimes you forget to turn off your alarm clock or whatever. You wake up Shabbos morning to your alarm and just hit the clock. And you're like, oh, it's Shabbos. Or let's say you've made that mistake in the recent past. You wake up on a Tuesday morning and you hear the alarm and you think, is it Shabbos?
Yeah.
Is it Shabbos? Yeah. Can I turn it off? Right?
Yeah.
There's that confusion in the first minutes. So it's a different transgression than just choosing, I don't care, it's Shabbos, it's too noisy, I want to go back to sleep, and you hit the alarm. That's a bigger avera than just like you woke up and you forgot it was Shabbos, and you hit it. But either you should have been careful not to set the alarm or to take it out of the room,
or to sleep
with more consciousness, you know, whatever it is, something was missing there that allowed that to happen.
Each time something like that happens, I put it on my list to double check
Before
the next Shabbos. Uh-huh. I have a bathroom light that I am so tempted, so I have it has a little box out in front, so I don't tape light switches or anything, but I just put a bottle that I have to hit that bottle if I were to go inadvertently for that light switch or something.
Right,
just something to jog me. But
it's like taping the
cabinets
or face
thing down. Yeah.
You know, you're not locking them.
Right.
You just want to make it so that you won't reach for the spices in that cabinet by mistake.
Right, just as a reminder and a protection. Right. Yeah.
The precept of a woman's offering after giving birth. So, after a woman gives birth, she brings an offering when the days of purity are over for a son or for a daughter are completed. And this offering is a lamb in its first year for an olah, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. If she's poor, she can bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons for an olah and one for a sin offering. So, why a sin offering is the question. And the answer for why a sin offering is because, in general,
this is funny,
on the birth table, the woman says,
anything.
I am never doing that again.
Ever.
I am never giving birth again. I'm never having sex again. I'm never doing anything that's going to get me in this position again.
Ever.
Ever. Never.
Right.
And then she's shortly regrets saying that.
Yeah.
So, but apparently it's
sort of funny.
Yeah.
Obviously it's gone on forever.
Yeah. It is considered to be a thing that a woman takes an inappropriate neder. She makes a vow, right? Mm-hmm. She makes a vow that she's not going to keep right there in the throes of labor. And so for that, she brings an atonement offering.
Unless she really means it. It's 6 months later and I am keen.
I still don't want
The reality is time does.
We'd all be only children.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we all be only children?
Time does cure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting because that's one of the arguments against men being in the delivery room. Is that women get flooded with restorative chemicals that help them forget the pain and the trauma of the whole thing. And their husbands don't.
Have
and they
that.
See how they
don't.
They
don't. So they saw their wives in all that pain, and then they're like,
should I ever do that's this for okay. again?
Maybe yeah. that's okay.
Well,
maybe
that's
the only way they can for have some, a true empathy. You
yeah,
know,
but for
the
some
situation.
For some couples, yeah, it yeah, actually causes true. Some problems.
I understand
I'm
kidney
sure
stones. I understand men should have kidney stones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. As close as they so. Can come.
Right, so anyway.
Really good kidney stone. Yeah.
They should all be spared, and so should women be yeah. spared. Nobody should have to experience that kind yeah. of pain. The world should be restored. So we don't have to have that. But meanwhile, that's why she brings us an offering. Okay, now I want to look at this. We have a few minutes to discuss this. This is interesting. The precept regarding the ritual uncleanness of a metzora. So just pointing out here, I forgot about this, but it points out in this paragraph here at the bottom of 2:14 that tsaras.
Right, that's right, that's right. It's a skin ailment.
Is a skin ailment, right. But that
just
sounds...
Read, which we just read.
But it sounds like psoriasis.
But it's not.
Mm-hmm. Psoriasis and
or
psoriasis.
Or mitzrayim. It's mm-hmm. that, isn't it also
well,
that
tsar, right? Mitzor, but this is actually a different root.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. But tsaras and psoriasis sounds similar in English, mm-hmm. and it is a skin ailment. So
but it's not psoriasis.
It is not psoriasis. Right. Right. Well, so is it the same thing? Isn't it the same? It's not the same thing, and yet it is a skin ailment. And so it's possible that the word psoriasis was applied to skin ailments coming from tsaras, coming from tsaras, that word would be applied to other skin ailments, even if it wasn't this, because there is a physical way that it looks, and yet it has a spiritual underpinning. So so this I find fascinating. The whole thing, let's see, where should we start here?
But leprosy, is this where leprosy comes in or no? That it's
yes
in,
and no. Not. So this is the incorrect source. This is the source
leprosy.
Of the incorrect understanding of leprosy.
Because I actually just came up with my mom and I was saying, I don't think it really is leprosy.
It's not leprosy.
Like, right, but it's like people think it's leprosy,
yes.
but mm-hmm. it's not leprosy.
Yes. So leprosy as a
but
disease.
But leprosy was treated similarly.
Leprosy as a disease is contagious and
right.
profoundly
disfiguring.
So you would want to quarantine somebody or separate them from the general population because of how bad it is, how
well,
disfiguring
now,
it is, and how contagious it is.
But now, with drugs and stuff...
Yeah, they're antibiotics.
Right,
yeah.
So it's totally different. It's the same yeah. thing as mental institutions. I went mm-hmm. to Williamsburg, Virginia, and saw their mental hospital. It was interesting. They had rooms restored to different time periods. So the first room was like straw on the floor
really?
And chains.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And the second room... So that was like from the 1700s. And then the 1800s was a cot and bars on the window, basically just a cot. And I think it even had a desk. But the...
So this
still have
was
a, chain.
A museum.
Yeah, museum. It was a mental hospital.
But it was
but
a
they
museum.
Restored it to very different places.
To
yeah.
show the different
yeah.
ages
and
of
then
mental health.
Modern is like just like a dorm room. Mm-hmm. So they said, what's the difference between you know, that and that? It's that today we have medical chains. We don't
drug
need
people.
We
right.
don't need mm-hmm. external chains to hold mm-hmm. somebody down. Right. We can give them Thorazine or whatever
so
is necessary.
Make them basically
to,
incapable of
right to either make them incapable of harm or
harm
to others if they're
themselves.
That dangerous, or at least to settle if they're not so dangerous, so that there's a profound difference in how. Yeah. So of course, for everything else too, we don't quarantine people anymore. Usually, except for let's say drug resistant TB. We still do want to quarantine people, and against their will, just like that guy that we brought to mm-hmm. you know, Colorado, and he had to be quarantined against his will. So for public health concerns, especially in this mobile world, we do have certain things, but that's only when our modern treatments don't help. Mm-hmm. But today, we don't think about it at all. We were just, somebody this morning over breakfast, we were just talking about something. Oh, plague. Mm-hmm. There's an article about seeking new digs for prairie dogs. The Wall Street Journal always has cute headlines. The Times doesn't do that, but the Wall Street Journal has like little puns in their headlines. Seeking new digs for prairie dogs. So Viva said that they carry the plague. It's really dangerous. You shouldn't let your dogs near prairie dogs because the fleas on the prairie dogs go to the dogs. Doesn't hurt the prairie dog or the dog, but could hurt you. You could get the plague. So that sounds terrible, right? She said, but it's not that big a deal. Plague is not that harmful. You just go to the doctor and get some pills and you're fine. So that's, you know, her
right, a different
21st century view. Big deal, the plague.
Yeah.
What's the big deal? Who cares, you know?
Right.
Just go get some pills and you'll be better.
Entire communities used to be wiped out. But.
Right, yeah. right. So we'd have totally different sensibilities and sensitivities on everything today, from walking barefoot to going outside with your head wet to leaving a window open.
Open in
to
the rain.
All that stuff, because what's the big deal? You just go to the doctor and get some pills and you're fine, you know, and we count on that. Anyway, so leprosy, of course, at the time, people were quarantined, and then there was a stigma attached to that. But I think some of the stigma was not just that you're quarantined. There's a stigma people don't want to get it from you. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of that. But I think it was reinforced by the stigma in the Torah that the... So it's not leprosy, but the two somehow got connected. And I think that's through the Christians, although the Christians must have been picking up on something mm-hmm. that was going on at the time. That the disease of tzaras, and the person who has it is called a metzora, but the disease of tzaras is a disease that is basically like wearing a red letter A. It says, I did something wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, you only got it because you did an avera. Right. So, yeah, it's a bad thing to have to
wear it
out loud.
But this isn't even leprosy, though, what we're talking
not
about.
Not leprosy, right. So if you would do, yeah, yeah, it's not the same
not
disease.
The leprosy that we know of today.
Do we hold to that today, that you only would get that kind of skin disease from doing an Aveira?
So that's what it says right here. Okay, so let's just look inside the mitzvah. To declare the mitzvah unclean. So that's the mitzvah. In other words, it is a religious duty for us that whoever has the affliction of tzaraat should come to the Kohen to ask him about his skin ailment, and the Kohen will declare him ritually impure or pure. He should behave in accord with the written Torah as the Kohen will command him, and not take the matter as an illness that occurs by chance. So now he's saying there are illnesses that can occur by chance.
Look how long it is.
But some don't. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Oh my gosh.
Right. But, sorry, I want to make sure we had enough time to look at it.
But we also can't go to the Kohen Gadol today and say...
Right. First of all, it doesn't have to be a Kohen Gadol. Any Kohen will do. But second of all, we don't get this illness today. Mm-hmm. This illness does not show up today. So there is no chance that what you're seeing anywhere on skin, body, or clothes is tzaraat. It doesn't exist today.
See, I don't have.
Right. It's not.
I do not have.
Anyway, you're red and this would be white.
Right. It has to do with
it's
whiteness.
White. Yeah. It's whiteness. Right. So anybody who says
that it's just ugly. You think when you think of the people that have that sensitivity... Like my daughter in Israel got some kind of a fungal thing or whatever mm-hmm. that takes the pigment
and
out.
Right, and it turns you white,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And black
oh,
people
tinea
get it and
versicola.
Turns them pink, right?
Mm-hmm. That's like, it's fungus, mm-hmm. yeah. It's
yes,
tinea
said,
versicola.
Some kind of a fungus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Takes
mm-hmm. So we do have things that look similar mm-hmm. or that could help us
it can go
understand
either way, but
what it might look
dark,
like today.
Looks
that's
whiter,
still not the same thing.
Like it's whiter.
Right.
Michael Jackson.
Right, right.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that's what he claimed to have. Yeah.
Oh, that's vertiligo. That's vertiligo. That's different.
Oh, that's there. Okay, you're right. I remember
tinea
that
tinea versicolor,
word.
The Celsin blue, that's the selenium can gets rid of it, tinea versicolor.
Oh, okay.
But vertiligo is where you're, it's like more in blacks where your right. pigment's
the pigment
gone. But that's
right.
that's different.
That's a totally, yeah, I was talking
this
about
is,
that.
Yeah, this is more of a fungus
of.
And it's the selenium mm-hmm.
oh,
that gets
okay.
rid of it. Yeah,
all right, thanks for
things.
Mentioning that word because I recognize that.
Yeah,
okay.
it's two different things.
Okay, so this.
I think we have a medical expert.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
very
right.
helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for coming. Okay, third paragraph. In substance, it is a tzaraat ailment when one or many places on the skin of a person's flesh turn white, those places being so very light that their whiteness resembles the whiteness of the membrane about an egg, or even goes beyond it in lightness. But as long as it is duller than the appearance of an egg's membrane, that is not a tzaraat ailment, but rather a bohuk, a dull, bright, shiny patch of skin. In other words, another illness, which is not any kind of tzaraat disease at all, but like the varieties of rashes or other sorts of afflictions that form in the human being. So it's interesting. So he said there's definitely all kinds of skin afflictions, as we just discussed, and there's a specific category called tzaraat, which is a physical manifestation of a spiritual ailment. So now he goes into discuss a little bit what they look like, which we're not going
to
do.
Didn't that just happen to Miriam in our...
Yes, exactly. Right. Just last weekend, and it's a mitzvah to remember, so everybody have in mind right now you're doing a mitzvah, dear Raisa, mm-hmm. to remember the story of Miriam where she speaks Lashon Hara against her brother Moshe, mm-hmm. and when she does that, her skin becomes white as mm-hmm. snow. Mm-hmm. And then Aaron prays on her behalf and gets Moshe to forgive her, and all is better. Right, so it's interesting to see
don't
these
talk
three.
Talk about your brother's wife.
Yeah.
Right, well, it's interesting to see these three parshiot in a row, because first you have the story of Miriam, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa to remember, a biblical mitzvah to remember every day. To remember that one, we have a custom of remembering every day. Remembering every day could just mean saying, "I remember what happened to Miriam. She spoke Lashon Hara, and her skin turned white, and you know that's what happened." Okay, that's that. Or The halachic parameters, if it's a mitzvah, could mean that it's to study the laws of Lashon Hara and try to avoid them, because she got that from speaking Lashon Hara. Now looking at these three parshiot in a row. So first you have Miriam, the sister, loving sister, speaking something negative against her brother, which causes tzarat. Next parsha this week is Shlach, the story of the spies who go into the land and speak Lashon Hara against the land, and that's very bad for the Jews, right? That's the 40 years, and the whole thing happens because of their speaking, their negative receiving of the information. When they went into the land, instead of just reporting on how to conquer it, they reported that they couldn't go, right? So they're receiving, they're forming that reception into words, and then the other people receiving what they said and believing it, bad for the Jews, right? And then it even escalates further to the parsha after that is Korach and the rebellion of Korach, where there's a whole uprising against Moshe and his leadership. That's not what happened with the spies. The spies were bad, but not as bad as that, really, where the whole camp was divided, right? And
bad,
the leadership
really
was
bad.
Challenged, right? So it's just an escalation, all three parshiot, of the negative power of words and what can happen, the destruction that can happen through those words.
Yeah, that's a good reminder, Lisa.
So, okay,
sticks
so let's...
stones.
Right. Which is not
true
at all.
Words will hurt.
Yes, they do.
I wonder if they still teach that to kids, because do they really?
Yeah,
the words can
my grandchildren know it.
Yeah.
Because
I said
true,
that to them.
Words now
are
the whole
they get
bullying.
Sticks and stones and bullying in school.
I said that to my grandkids.
Words
too, when
worse.
They were.
Yeah.
But in order to help a child deal with hearing hurtful things,
right.
It is something that helps them to deal with it.
Right. So on the one hand, you want to teach them that as a way to shield themselves, but not as
to justify
not
saying.
To justify saying, right. That's a tricky
Absolutely.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Tricky.
Yeah.
If somebody says you're ugly, you just have to walk past it.
Right.
But when you call somebody else ugly,
no, you can't say
it can't, right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a very tough line.
It's very.
I ran into
a 4-year-old.
Kids don't have a...
I ran into that problem of the double standard when this Shavuos, when I taught about Rachav. So Rachav was a prostitute for 30 years, and then she did tshuva. She's a non-Jewish prostitute, and then she did tshuva, and she converted to Judaism, and she changed her life around so much that she married Yehoshua. Right, the leader of the Jews. That's how far she brought herself to a place of Kedusha from a place of Tumah. So I taught the story as, look how far you could come. Right, everybody has the power to make good choices. Everybody can take themselves out of whatever situation is. Change yourself anytime. She was 40 years old when she made the decision, which means she began being a prostitute at 10, which means she came from a difficult life situation.
Somebody,
if she starts at 10,
somebody sold her or whatever.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So for 30 years from a difficult childhood, and yet she was able to completely transform herself to the point she could marry Yeshua. So somebody came over to me afterwards and says, what kind of a message is that? Don't you think that would like tell our husbands that it's okay that they could sleep around with prostitutes and that they always have a chance to redeem themselves? I thought, I never thought of that as the message from it, but that was a question.
Was it a class you taught to women? Or?
It was a class I taught to women in Montreal.
Oh, is that where you were? Oh.
Yeah, I went to Montreal for Shavuot.
That's a really good teaching you have on that whole thing. That is very good.
So anyway, it was interesting as a question.
Yes.
And especially Montreal is a much more, it's interesting, it's a much more international community. Mm-hmm. And I think it was probably a Moroccan woman who asked me. There's a big Moroccan community
which is
there.
Very different.
Very different
society.
Cultural experience.
Very different experience. So it was just interesting to see, you know, the different.
Makes you stop to think
yes.
a little bit about.
It does. It does.
But you can do that with everything, kind of twist
well,
it a little
bit.
Well,
I think you can.
Yeah.
Sort
of, see the other
sure.
side of it.
You can, but as a teacher,
cultural.
You should just
you need
be able to
be aware.
Have that. Right. You should be aware of what people could think.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Cultural. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, so now let's look, second paragraph, page 217. At the root of the precept lies the purpose to establish firmly in our spirits that the watchful care of the eternal Lord is individual. So, hashkacha pratit. The root of tzara'at is to establish, to create an experiential that we should know that Hashem watches over every individual. So I think that's an interesting thing. It's not to stop Lashon Hara, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's a fascinating thing. The root of the precept, according to him, lies the purpose to establish firmly in our spirits that the watchful care of the eternal Lord is individual over every over each and every one among human beings, and his eyes are open to observe all their ways, as it is written in Job, in Eov. For his eyes are upon the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. Hence he adjured us to give thought to this evil disease and to consider the sin that caused it. Long ago, our sages of blessed memory said that it comes mostly, but not exclusively, for the sin of evil gossip. And we should not assume it to happen by way of chance. We are then to come to the Kohen, who stands as a minister for the atonement of sinners. In the company of the agent of atonement, perhaps he, the sinner, will meditate on repentance. So even just going to the Kohen is step one in the process, because you have to go and say, you know, you have to first think, oh my gosh, what could this mean? Have it identified. So that's step one. And then he will be shut away, quarantined for a few days, so that he can think over his affairs unhurriedly and examine his deeds. So that, you know, you're put on the thinking chair.
It just says a few days. It doesn't, I thought it was, it's not a prescribed number of days. Huh?
I think it depends on what it is. Mm-hmm. So, and it depends on how bad it is and all different kinds of things. That, and so initially there's a process where it may be not quite clear if it's tzaraat or not. So that person would get separated for 7 days to see how it develops. Mm-hmm. And then look at it. So hopefully during that 7 days the person does tshuva and it doesn't develop. And then it's never declared tamei, and then the person doesn't need the whole purification ceremony. However, if it does develop, if they didn't do it, so then they're declared tamei, or if the person comes with the kohen already worth it, properly developed, and you can see clearly, so then they're called tamei. And anyway, they're quarantined then for them to do tshuva during that time period. And then they have a whole ceremony they have to go through to get out of the tumah that they brought themselves into. So, but here's where I want to spend a little more time. There's no time to spend. Okay, the bottom of page 217. So this is very interesting. So now we're going to talk about hashgacha pratit a little bit, hashgacha pratis. Because there's two different opinions here. And we seem, even though he says he holds by the third, we seem to hold closer to the first today. But let's look and see what he has to say. For there are certain groups of people who think that the watchful care of the eternal Lord, blessed is he, is over all species individually, both over humans and over other living creatures. Then there are the groups among them who believe that the watchful care of the eternal Lord, blessed is he, is over all things of the world, whether living creatures or any other things. In other words, not one small entity will move in this world except by his desire, blessed be he, and by his decree, to such an extent that they believe that when one leaf falls from a tree, he decreed over it that it should fall, and it is impossible for the time of its fall to be delayed or advanced by even a moment. But this view is very removed from human reason. Then there are evil groups that think that he, blessed is he, does not set his watchful care about at all about any matters of this lowly world, whether about humans or other living creatures. This is the view of the heretics, evil and bitter. However, according to what I have heard, we, masters of the true religion, assume his watchful care, blessed is he, to be over all species of living creatures generally. In other words, this is interesting, every one of the species created in the world will permanently endure. It will never end and perish entirely, as by his providential care, a way of existence will be found for everything. As for the human species, it is our belief that his providential care, blessed is he, is for each and every one individually, and it is he who understands all their doings. That's Psalms. So we receive the teaching from our great luminaries, and we will also find many verses about it which show the matter is so. So I think it's very interesting because we...
So you're saying that what we hold is that it's to all species.
No, that it's extremely detailed to the point of the leaf is pretty much
that's
the mainstream. It is sort of the second one, yeah. Second of the
third, yeah,
wow. Of the four, really, in a way. There's four here because he's saying there's two, just species, then every little bitsy thing, and then there's not at all, and then there's kind of a blend. So we're in between number two and number four, really, because in general today we do pretty much hold that God is in charge of everything, and there is a machloket, a longer standing argument in this case, over whether every little thing, is there anything that Hashem allows to happen on its own? It's a question, and the Sefer HaChinuch even discusses, for instance, when he talks about not mixing species, you're not allowed to graft from one tree to another of different species. Why not? because there's a malach, there is a spiritual energy that's in charge of each species. And if you mix the two things together, it sends up into the spiritual realms a confusion over which malach is in charge of that tree now. Is it the apple tree or the plum tree? Right? Like, I mean, if you're mixing the two, I don't know which one's mixed, but to create nectarines, right? Those are peaches and plums, right? So is it the peach malach or the plum malach who's in charge of the nectarine tree? It turns out that eventually a nectarine malach is created who's now in charge of nectarine trees. But initially, we human beings aren't supposed to, we Jews aren't supposed to do that, because it sends negative forces up to the realms of the malachim who are in charge.
So should we eat them once they've been developed? Okay.
Yeah, we're allowed to eat them once they're developed. We're
fluat,
just not allowed to do that.
Yeah, the new one.
Yeah, we're permitted. We're permitted to eat them, but we're not allowed to make them. So, but it's interesting here that he's talking about. So, we do have a concept. The Ramchal certainly discusses the concept that every species has a malach as a general thing. That there's not hashgacha pratit over each individual member of the species. So, a dog getting hit by a car isn't about the dog's hashgacha, but might be about the driver's hashgacha. Right, that the driver as a human being had that. And then there's a machloket also, is there hashgacha pratit over every single human being, over just Jews, and non-Jews have more of a general hashgacha. They certainly are human beings created in the image of God and have hashgacha. But so it's a question here, and he's discussing what level. So today it seems that we do hold species. Each species has its own malach, and each individual member of each species doesn't have individual providence over God. So whether a tree stays or doesn't stay, according to the Ramchal, the species isn't going to go, but that tree might. In a way, the same thing with human beings. The species of human beings isn't going to go, but that individual. And the same thing with Jews. Jews will remain forever, but each individual Jew doesn't have a promise of staying alive even through mitzvot, right? There's not, there's not that individual promise. Certainly not forever, and not even to necessarily be protected just because they're doing mitzvot. I mean, we certainly saw that in the Holocaust. There are plenty of people who did great things,
great things,
and you know,
right.
they were mowed down along with the rest. So,
you mean in the current form?
In which current form?
In the current form.
Pre-Messianic.
Correct. No, human beings, right? That in the physical shape.
Yeah.
The soul is eternal for sure,
right.
But that the physical may not be, is not.
We may die, but our. But the species goes on.
And then the species goes on. So anyway, what he's saying is that, let's see, let's look back at what he's saying. It's just interesting. Also, he says that each species will permanently endure. So that's certainly not the case scientifically today. We don't see that. We do see species that become
completely
extinct, right? So that wouldn't be something that he would have had knowledge of at the time. So, but that we do understand that there is general hashgacha over species, but individual hashgacha over human beings. So he's talking about a blended matter where so we do understand a blended situation of hashgacha klalit and hashgacha pratit, general providence and individual providence, and they're blend together. And it's a question, the machloket really is, that we still live in today is, and it's you can be on any place in this spectrum is kosher, that not one blade of grass grows without a malach hitting it and saying grow, all the way to kind of a general, God watches over and does direct the general shape of our lives, but maybe a blade of grass, he could just tell the whole yard, grow, you know, and it's not each individual blade. That's within the spectrum of what's acceptable today. But he's saying that blade of grass theology would be removed from human reason. That's his particular point of view. So I would like to learn more about that. And we'll continue next week. Bezrat Hashem.